Hiya, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Today we're talking about a really beautiful book, The Rani of Jhansi, Gender, History and Fable in India by Harleen Singh, published by Cambridge University Press. Harleen is Associate Professor of Literature, South Asian Studies and Women's Studies at Brandeis University, and the book is a wonderful exploration of the various different representations of the Rani of Jhansi, the famous 19th century queen who led her troops into battle against the British and died on the battlefield. I had the pleasure of talking with Harleen just a few moments before. Okay, so without any further ado, very happy to welcome Harleen Singh to the show. Thanks a lot for coming on, and thanks a lot for your wonderful book.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be this.
Great. So before we get to the book yourself, always on the podcast, we want to know a little bit about yourself, your past research interests, and how you ended up being interested in writing this book that we're going to talk about today.
Well, you know, my research, ever since I guess I was an undergraduate, I've been working on narratives around women from India. So looking at authors who are women, but also then looking at the ways in which literature articulates this idea of the Indian woman. So I'd always been interested in figurations of, you know, particularly gendered figurations here. But this book, in many ways, is has a lot to do with my childhood, was growing up in India, and I mentioned this later on in the afterword in the book. But you know, as a child, I saw the first Saurabh Modi Rani of Jhansi broadcast on what was then India's only TV channel, Doordarshan, and on the occasion of Independence Day. And I was taken up, I think, you know, as a young child, and I was taken up by the figure of this queen who stood up to, you know, to the British. And the next day I ran off to the bookstore and found myself what we used to call the Amar Chitra Katha. These are the comic books which have, you know, have told the picture stories of India's history and religion and culture and so on and so forth. And so really my first introduction to the Rani of Jhansi was a comic book. And it was, you know, this beautiful cover with her resplendent in red and gold clothes, you know, astride her horse, you know, facing hundreds of British soldiers. And I was fired up by how she was imagined and what she could mean for so many people. And then, of course, as I grew up and got into fights with boys in my school, I'd often hear the teachers tell us, you know, who do you think you are, the Rani of Jhansi? You want to be fighting against with boys? And so she stayed in my mind. And eventually, as I got through my master and my doctoral work, I was thinking about her and looking at her as a chapter in a book project dissertation project on the 1857 rebellion. But, you know, lo and behold, she took over. You know, as I began to do research for one chapter, I began to see a book emerging. And, you know, she was larger than anything else that I could really get my hands on in terms of the rebellion. And I thought that, and of course, it has a lot to do with my teachers who guided me on this, and I thought, you know, a book could be written about her. And of course, there have been hundreds of books written about her, but biographies and, you know, history books which tell her story. But I didn't find very many things. In fact, there was only one book before written by Libra Joyce Chapman about her, but even then, that's a kind of a historical retelling of her story. But there was really no consideration of her as a figure of representation, as a figure of literature, and as a figure of, you know, Indian cultural history. I'm sorry about that. I tried to mute the phone, but I guess that didn't happen. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought there, but getting back to it. But there was really no book or article and other things that I could find when I was doing this research, which really took, you know, stock of what it meant to represent this woman from Indian history and to represent her at different points and times in history, in literature, in film, in folk poetry, and to move forward from there. So that's really how I got to this project.
Mm-hmm. And we're glad you did find your way, because it really is a fascinating book. I can't recommend it enough to listeners. Maybe just because this podcast will also be cross-posted in different channels, not only in the South Asian channel, could you tell us a little bit about 1857 and why it was so important, just for those people who aren't familiar with the history?
Absolutely. So 1857, you know, really is a watershed event in, you know, you could call it British Indian history, in the colonial and then the later post-colonial period, because until 1857, the British presence in India was controlled by the East India Company. It was still a mercantile presence. And in 1857, you know, people have, of course, various theories about it. You know, hundreds and thousands of books have been written about it and the causes for the rebellion in 1857, the results of the rebellion in 1857 or not. But in some ways, the simplest story is that, you know, a rebellion was sparked off by the insubordination of certain soldiers in a city called Meerut. And that then led to a large-scale rebellion that was then taken up by various kings, queens, and other people, the common people as well. And, of course, it was put down. It didn't amount to much, but it generated a great deal of literature around it as people began to imagine the mutinous conduct of the Indians, who until now had been really thought of as the kind of mild Hindu. And there was a lot of British writing on this at this point in time. And then 1857 marked the change, because after this, Queen Victoria became Empress, and it really became a dominion of the British Crown. So the East India Company was deprived of its possession. And from 1857 to 1947, when India gains independence, India is then a colony, a dominion of the Crown, rather than a colony of the East India Company. So it's a huge event for British and Indian history, because in the colonial period, and in many ways it led to a rethinking of governance for the British, but then it also became a symbol of the ways in which the rebellion could be undertaken against the British power. And it wasn't, you know, invoked many times by Gandhi's rhetoric, because, of course, it was, you know, the nonviolence and passive resistance. But it became a point of convergence for people to think about a rebellion against the British in the colonies.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the most important question in the context of your book is, you know, what role did the Rani have in this? Let's not talk so much about how she was represented as we'll go into detail in each of the chapters, but what's the sort of, you know, broad strokes sort of picture of what she did in the context of this rebellion?
Right. So, you know, in short, she fought against the British, and not in name and not in representation, but, you know, in the battlefield, on the battlefield, and died in combat. So she's extraordinary in those terms for actually being a queen who went into battle. Of course, Victoria was in battle, but Victoria was, you know, queen in terms of, you know, the battles when wars were carried out in her name. But here was an Indian queen who actually went into battle against the British. And the reason she's significant is, of course, because one of the main causes that people have spoken of in terms of 1857 is the policy of annexation. That under the East India Company, many states, such as Jhansi, where the Queen was from, actually lapsed into the control of the British as the King died and no natural heir emerged. And, you know, again, it's a complicated and historical formation there as well. So, you know, not as simplistic as I might make it out to be, but many such policies by the East India Company were seen to be interfering with the lives of Indians, and not just, you know, in their trade. And the Queen, you know, was one of the wives. She was married to the King of Jhansi, Gangadhar Rao, and he was, you know, he had gotten on in age by the time, and she was a young woman married to him. But one of the reasons for this marriage was the fact that he didn't have a natural heir with any of his previous wives, and it was thought that, you know, they would produce an heir together. But they had a son who died in infancy, And then they adopted a young relative as their son. However, under the policy of annexation, the adopted heir was not recognized by the British when the king died. And so Jhansi, the kingdom, lapsed into the control of the British and was annexed by the British. And this then led to a series of correspondence and other things between the British and the East India Company and the Rani Lakshmibai of Jhansi. And, you know, there are various theories about it, whether she was someone who wanted to fight the British or not, or did or not. And, of course, as I point out in the book, there are various reasons for this. Nationalist reasons often want to naturalize her as a rebel who completely, you know, was from the get-go against the annexation and didn't want to have anything to do with the British and fought, was a rebel from the onset. British historians and other, you know, colonial historiography that has pointed out that she was a rather reluctant rebel and only got into the rebellion once the mutineers landed up at her doorstep. So there are various reasons around it, but she became a figurehead for the rebellion. People, you know, banded around this the figure of the queen fighting for the British. And so this is why she becomes an extremely important figure from 1857.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. That sets the scene for us nicely. You mentioned a little bit before that there wasn't really any scholarship before about her representations, and we'll talk about each of these four chapters. But before we do that, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the importance of looking at these representations. Like, what does looking at representations of her tell us? This is the discussion that you have in the introduction.
Right. So, you know, I think in some ways that the book engages the question of what constitutes the archive. Right. We have up to this point in time, you know, we have archives which are, you know, and many other historians have done it. I'm not a historian. I'm really a literary scholar. But in some ways, you know, more and more post-colonial frameworks have begun to reframe the question of how history is written. And one of the things that I wanted to undertake here was the importance of looking at the literary product, looking at the literary text as a way of configuring history, in so much as, you know, especially with the case of the Rani of Jhansi, it's very hard to tell where rhetorical representations of her, literary representations of her end, and actual, if one can call that, you know, historical stories about her begin. As I point out, you know, that before 1857, there really was no reason to record the history of this one woman. And so whatever we have about her, historical, literary, cultural, comes to us after 1857. And that almost always, you know, colors how we are looking at her, because the rebellion already sets her up as a figure of importance and significance. And so it was important for me that, you know, to look at these various accounts, to look not only at the intersections of literature and history, but also the ways in which it's very important for us, especially in a place like, I wouldn't say a place like India, but to look at like the place of Indian history and Indian literature, especially within the colonial and post-colonial framework, to think about how narratives of these, you know, famous personages of history have emerged, and what these narratives mean for us in thinking about gender or history, and also storytelling in India.
Wonderful. So let's talk about these different types of representations that you look at. You look at four broadly grouped representations in the book. You show how she's a sexually promiscuous Indian whore. She's a heroic Aryan, and she's also a Hindu goddess of nationalism. And then, very interestingly, in the final chapter, you look at her as a folk symbol of indigenous resistance. So let's start, as you start in chapter two, you look at her representations against what's called the rape script. And you do this as a way of unmasking the portrayal of this sort of eroticization of power. So can you tell us a little bit about the novels that you're analyzing here and how they show, and this is the title of the chapter, how they show Rani is enslaving masculinity.
Well, so the novels here, chapter two is really looking at Victorian representations of the Rani. And this is very important because, of course, some of the first representations that we are able to engage are Victorian representations because, of course, literature in English is being written at a greater rate in England about this, and the mutiny, as it's called in colonial historiography, it really fires up the imagination, and it's not so much her that I think Victorian novels are representing, but really the British in India. But in representing the British in India during this period of the mutiny, they can't help but engage these large figures who had so fired up the imagination. And it's very interesting that in chapter two, both the novels that I engage, one is called The Rani, and the next one is called The Queen's Desire. Both of these, right? I mean, Gillian, again, that's a pseudonym for Major J.N.H. MacLean, and Hume Nesbitt, who writes The Queen's Desire. Both of these are late 19th century novels. And both of them, there are other things that are going on. The queen is not really the central character as such, but she becomes in some ways a vehicle for the destiny of the British characters involved in these novels. And in both these novels, she is really depicted as in the framework, the 1857 mutiny engendered, and other people have written books about this, the rape script of the mutiny, which was really a kind of sensationalized narrative of 1857, where British women were being kidnapped, abducted, separated from their families, and raped and kept in the harems of the various kings and other people. And I have found these novels in which Rani Lakshmibai, an Indian woman who was usually represented in Victorian fiction as someone who had to be rescued from Indian masculinity, someone who was, submissive, subordinate, all of these, obsequious qualities attached to them. And yet here you had this queen who fought against the British. And so how could she be included in these sensational narratives about 1857 when she didn't fit any of those, stereotypes? And what I found was that, more often than not, she was depicted as a threat to Indian domesticity. So, of course, she couldn't be shown as, abducting and kidnapping British women, which would have required a much larger leap, I think, of imagination. Yes. she was depicted as, as someone who disrupted British domesticity by being extremely promiscuous towards British men. Mm-hmm. And going so far as being a seductress, seducing British men, and in the Queen's Desire, actually kidnapping and keeping a British soldier in her harem, for her purposes. So it was very interesting to me that in the framework of 1857. In which these rape narratives are focused on Indian men raping and kidnapping and raping British women, we had these rather anomalous representations of the Queen of Jhansi, the Rani Lakshmibai, as someone who could, on the one hand, couldn't help but give in to British masculinity, be seduced by it also, but did so in a way that really represented a kind of rapacious, devouring sexuality, and which was focused on British men.
Ah, wonderful. So, and in the next chapter, in a very different representation, you talk about how the Rani is constructed by others as a heroic Aryan woman. So I suppose if the last chapter was about sex or sexuality, this chapter is very much about race.
Right. So it was, it was very interesting to me, as one would imagine that, all representations of the Rani would be in this negative mode of her being a kind of voracious, sexually crazed Indian woman, dying to have a harem full of British men. And these were most of the representations I was finding. But then I also chanced upon on a rather, heroic representations, which weren't entirely approving, but were, you know, almost reluctantly acknowledging her heroism, but doing so in the framework of a fellow Aryan. And I began to think more and more about how the 19th century, race theorists and others and philologists were beginning to construct this notion of race and how, you know, how it applied to the Rani of Jhansi. And I guess I really begin by thinking, you know, about European philology, which, you know, on Max Müller's work and other, where this idea of Aryan origin began to emerge, you know, and in some ways as a response to the anti-Semitism, where the idea of a kind of, you know, origin in Eden really prompted people to look elsewhere. And I began to think more about the ways in which she was also, you know, she was heroic and she was, you know, a woman fighting against, you know, in battle against the British, and many people looked upon her, and many writers later looked upon her with great approval. And in these, you know, narratives of approval, what I began to see is that there were ways in which there wasn't just dissonance, but a kind of alignment, a kind of allegiance between the Rani as royalty and as a fellow Aryan who, in fighting against the British, was not so much a rebel, but really a kind of fellow Aryan who could not help but fight against what she perceived of as injustice. So the novels don't go so far as to say, oh, yes, the British were unjust. But they do grudgingly acknowledge that, you know, here was this heroic woman fighting against the British. And interestingly enough, these representations then engage theories of caste, because she is Aryan, but, you know, the Aryan is really constructed in these novels as upper caste Brahmins, right? Sometimes the Kshatriya, sometimes the warrior class. But even in conceiving of the Rani as an Aryan, it's easy enough for these narratives to do, because she was, of course, from the Brahmin caste, you know, historically speaking. So this chapter really looks at, you know, primarily a novel from 1901 written by Michael White called Lakshmibai Rani of Jhansi, the Jeanne d'Arc of India, where her anti-colonial sentiments, you know, are in some ways glossed over, because she's really compared to this European model of saintly womanhood, the Joan of Arc. But the fact that she's a Hindu Brahmin also makes it easier to recast her as an Aryan, right? And I think that this is this kind of figuration really lends itself to an analysis of colonial ambivalence, and also to to an analysis of the ways in which race and the construction of race began to really emerge around this schism of 1857, where, you know, it was no longer simply it became necessary in some ways to very clearly demarcate us and them. To clearly demarcate the British from the Indian, not just as you know, those who are belonging to another civilization, but to really demarcate this on the basis of racial difference. And so she emerges here then as this kind of problematic figure who's both heroic in being a Brahmin, being an Aryan, and fighting against the British, but she's responsible for the deaths for the loss of British lives, for the taking of British lives, women, men, and children included, and so that makes it rather problematic to recast her simply as heroic. And I think that's the kind of tension that I work at in the chapter.
Thank you. I was wondering, in both of these chapters, as I was reading them, I was wondering how popular, or do we know how popular these books were at the time, like back in Britain, or in also like amongst the colonial officers and so on in India? Do we know if they were well read?
I think we, you know, all the scholarship on, and there's been a lot of scholarship on Victorian novel and its circulation, and all of it, you know, points to the fact that there was an increased number of readers, at least in England. I think there was a limited circulation amongst the reading classes, you know, in the reading classes in India. And here I'm talking about British colonialists who were in India. There was some, But as you know, passage from England to India, the coming of books back and forth, it wasn't that easy. You know, compared to the internet age now, one is almost, you know, perplexed to find out how word really got from one end to the other. But it seems like people still were able to communicate. And so, yes, so I think there was greater circulation in England, less so in India. But I think that one has to separate in some ways the circulation of these books, the novels, the texts, from the circulation of a kind of cultural representation. Mm-hmm. So even if people were not reading the novels in such great number, you know, representations of the Rani, of Nana Sahib, Tante Tope, these other figures of 1857 in English newspapers, in, you know, in other dispatches and other ways, in other print culture, I think that people were far more familiar with these figures and with the notion of 1857 than we might think they were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's just what I had in my mind. Because, I mean, I read one, with my own research, I read one book written by a civil servant, and but I found one reference to someone else talking about it, but then no one else in the city ever knew this book existed. So I was always wondering, yeah, how, I mean, especially at that time, like you said,
right.
Books, how easily did books circulate, especially in amongst the colony. So let's talk a little bit, like you talk about
If I could just step back to say, you know, one thing, Ian, which is that, I mean, on the one hand, you didn't have the circulation, but what's amazing is that many of these authors, especially in the Victorian period, almost all the books that I've read, that I've analyzed, at least for the book, almost all the authors claim to have experience in India. So you know, there's a way in which, you know, even if those books were not circulating, there's a way in which experience and the authenticity, in some ways, as these authors were aspiring to, of having served in India, was really underwriting their own legitimacy as authors. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, many of these authors talk about their own military service, their family's military service, and claim a kind of, you know, India old hand, you know, title for themselves. So you know, it's a rather complex negotiation, because even as they're representing the Rani of Jhansi as one of them, one of us, you know, an Aryan, not an Aryan, a rebel, a heroic figure, there's also a certain amount of negotiation going on the part of the author themselves, as they're thinking of themselves as these old India hands, but also, you know, loyal British subjects, and in some ways negotiating their own identities and their own positions.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, I don't know what it's like now in the US, but it's certainly in the UK, you can find so many of these colonial era novels now for sale, because in a sort of a sad way, the government here is shutting down all the libraries. So all the libraries are getting rid of their stock on the internet. So you can find these old Victorian novels very cheaply. And some totally fascinating, you know, works out there. Let's talk a little bit, as you talk in the second half of the book, how she was portrayed by Indians. And my first experience with the Rani was half watching a film at somebody's house when I was in India. And there she was very much portrayed as a hero. I mean, and some of the great names have represented her, like some of the great Indian names have represented her. But as you show in chapter four, then there is still contradictions there in how she's represented. So tell us a little bit about how she's sort of represented as this nationalist hero and what the tensions are there.
Well, you know, I think it's fair to say that most Indian representations of her are, of course, complementary. You know, that more often than not, even when these tensions are brought out, for Indian historiography as well as Indian literary culture, the Rani of Jhansi really represents a kind of, a heroic figure from the past who's very inspiring. You know, there's whatever we may think about, you know, how she got into the battle or not, there's no getting around the fact that here was a woman, probably from an extremely sheltered life, who led her troops in battle against the British and died on the battlefield. And especially in the context of Indian nationalism, She became, you know, a figure without a peerless figure in some ways, you know, without comparison, and people represented her or spoke about her in myriad ways. In this chapter, one of the things I of course do get at is that, and yet there is some tension there, because in the nonviolent movement against the British and Gandhi's movement against the British, the Congress-inspired movement against the British, she wasn't really, you know, brought out as a figure, as an inspiring figure of history. In fact, I was hard-pressed to find anything in Gandhi's writing that referred to her. And Gandhi did refer to, the Indian goddesses and to Indian, you know, women and figures of Indian women as symbols from which the passive resistance could draw inspiration, but really there isn't much reference to the Rani of Jhansi. Jawaharlal Nehru, in his book Discovery of India, written while he was in prison, does refer to her and talks about her as this wonderful figure of Indian history. But I was really concerned here in also looking at genre, at looking at the ways in which the Hindi novel, Hindi poetry, and then Hindi film use narratives of the past, use historical narratives, and retell it in these various genres, in the process of nation building, right? That these genres, this literature, is really put to the service of nation building and what it is that they do with her. So, for example, you know, one of the Subhadra Kumari Chauhan's poem, Jhansi Ki Rani, written in 1930, has the refrain, Khub Ladi Mardani, Wo To Jhansi Wali Rani Thi. And as I point out, this is, you know, almost everyone, and by everyone I say, you know, middle class and those educated in India, and Hindi speakers, almost all of us in school knew this refrain. And in fact, even in popular culture, this refrain has really come to mark the Rani of Jhansi, and translated, it simply refers to as the one, you know, we've heard the story from the singers of the Bundela clan, the one, it was the Rani of Jhansi who fought like a man. And so this is something that I've known since I was a child, this poem, and I really wanted to be able to read it alongside Vrindavan Lal Verma's novel Jhansi Ki Rani Lakshmi Bai, which became, you know, one of the India's foremost novelists in Hindi, especially in terms of the historical novel, and I wanted to see the ways in which these different genres and these different authors were representing this heroic figure, you know, in the context of Indian nationalism. And then, of course, look at Sohrab Modi's film, Jhansi Ki Rani, which was India's first film in Technicolor, and to look at the ways in which this new format of retelling India's past, telling India's history, films, movies, and cinema, used the story of the Rani to retell a story. Mm-hmm. And what I found was very interesting, you know. So there are contradictions, there are paradoxes, there are places where these narratives run parallel to each other. But almost all three of these texts, you know, the poem, the novel, the film, have been referred to, have been talked about in other places. But again, I was hard pressed to find anything in which, you know, representations of the Rani in Hindi had been considered together to understand what they said about Hindi literature, about, you know, history in India, and to really talk about the ways in which genre, language, literature, and history were emerging, and actually playing a decisive role in representing history to the reading masses and to the cinema going masses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. The final chapter you have in the book is really amazing, because this biography just sounds amazing. This is offers a completely radical, different representation than anything we've talked about so far. In the same way, because of the sources, I suppose, it uses to bring about this representation. In this, she becomes a hero of the people. So, can you tell us a little bit about this book, and then also how you interpret it?
Right. So, you know, and as I was looking at, you know, and in some ways the chapters in the book follow in the order, not only because of chronology, but also because in some ways they represent really my journey, just that I was first acquainted with literary representations of the Rani of Jhansi in Victorian texts that I was reading as a scholar of 19th century literature, British literature. And then it caused me, you know, it made me think more about the ways in which I had assimilated representations of the Rani into my own cultural framework in terms of the Hindi poem, the novels, and Hindi cinema. And then I began to see, well, you know, of course, it was a to be expected in some ways that, you know, even as the Rani represented this figure of dissonance and conflict and chaos for British novelists, that she would represent freedom, cohesion, and in some ways a coherent push forward for independence for the nationalists. But I wondered if there had been, in fact, that well, let me take that back. But I was cognizant of the fact that most of these nationalist representations of the Rani were coming from a particular upper caste literary writing and cultural formation. And I wondered, you know, how it was that perhaps, you know, were there anything that was critical about her, you know, or was she just being, you know, represented as this heroic figure always, even in Indian writings. And then I came across Mahashweta Devi's work. And of course, Mahashweta Devi is, and I'd known her other work before, and she is a very famous writer in Bengali and a famous activist for indigenous rights in post-colonial India. Gayatri Spivak has most famously translated her work in the Western Academy. But I, again, found that actually one of her earliest, Mahashweta Devi's earliest works, was a biography/novel of the Rani of Jhansi, called Jhansi Rani, or translated simply as the Rani of Jhansi. It was translated, you know, later as the Queen of Jhansi. But this was one of her earliest works, written in 1957. 1956, I beg your pardon, published in 1956. And yet there wasn't really any scholarship on this work, even though there had been scholarship on her short stories and other things. But there was no scholarship on Mahashweta Devi's novel, Jhansi Rani, which is about the Rani of Jhansi. So I began to look at that more carefully. And it's a fascinating and amazing text because, you know, unlike Vrindavan Lal Verma's novel, The Rani of Jhansi, which came out just at the cusp of Indian independence and is celebrated in India and Hindi literature, Mahashweta Devi's book was, you know, a book written by a woman, but it was also informal and nonconformist in the ways in which it wasn't writing a straightforward history. Mahashweta Devi was very concerned that the story of this extraordinary woman be told not only as a story, you know, as employing the history from above, but really drawing on the narratives and folk stories and histories of the ways in which the Rani was understood as a hero of the people, as a folk hero. And so her, even as Mahashweta Devi looks at, you know, her book is very well researched. You know, it doesn't have the level of footnoting and endnoting that our books do nowadays. But perhaps that's to the good because it reads. And she employs all kinds of archives here. You know, she talks about, you know, speaking to people in Jhansi, talking, you know, she employs dramas and poetry and stories and songs about the Rani of Jhansi. And you know, goes forward to tell the story of the Rani of Jhansi not only as this queen, as this, you know, elite figure, as this elite Brahmin figure, but really as someone who represented the concern and causes of the indigenous peoples, the lower castes and the poorer people of India, and she really holds her out. And one of my one of my favorite things about, you know, Mashwata Devi's book about the Rani of Jhansi is that she talks about her as this woman who the Rani who is not yet dead, right? And she talks a lot about the ways in which people will not believe that the Rani has died, that she continues to be alive, because in some ways the promises of independence have not yet been met. And in Mashwata Devi's book, the enduring figure, the enduring story of the Rani symbolizes the continued need for rebellion and resistance against a nationalist state which has in some ways run roughshod over the desires and needs of its own people. And then as I was looking at her, you know, we've now in the last 10 years have had I wouldn't say the emergence, because there's always been Dalit historiography, but we've begun to see more of it in terms of print material. But that then I began to look at the ways in which Dalit historiography and Dalit literature now has actually, you know, taken for whom the Rani of Jhansi is a contentious figure. One who represents a kind of upper caste, you know, control of history, and an erasure of Dalit contribution to Indian resistance and rebellion against the British. And I was amazed to see, you know, the ways in which a Dalit heroine, Chalkari Bai, has really been put forth as the real Rani, you know, going so far as some Dalit scholarship, which goes on to say that, you know, like Mahashweta Devi is saying that the Rani is alive, but really she's alive because she ran away from the battlefield, and it's really Dalit women who were the true heroines of 1857. In some ways, you know, I think it brings for me the story full circle, starting from colonial representations to then nationalist representations, to then a kind of post-colonial relationship with history, which now must contend also with Dalit historiography that is pointing out the gaps in the ways in which history has been written, the ways in which literature has been understood, and the ways in which, idea of womanhood, of gender, has really been put forth. And I think in all of this conversation that we've had so far, as I've been talking more about her as a representation of literature and history, I failed really to mention in some ways the fact that all of these representations, whether they're sexualized or are based on race, you know, or nationalist representations, which still cull from, you know, Hindu versions of womanhood and heroism and the goddess, to looking now at Mahashweta Devi, who really looks at the Rani as a kind of feminist icon, and then moving on to Dalit historiography, which seeks to displace that kind of heroism around her, that she also tells the story in some ways of gender in India, of womanhood in India, and how it's been understood over the span of these, you know, well, I guess it'd be, you know, fair to say like 150 some years, and why that it still has resonance, as I point out, in the afterword, for a country where, you know, we have so many streets named after the Rani of Jhansi, where women may still not walk in safety.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's wonderful the way it closes the book, because it shows, or maybe close wasn't the right word, it shows there can be no closure on any representation of the Rani. She's always going to be open to new representations, no matter how often it tried to be closed by colonialists or by nationalists. It's always open to new and fresh interpretations. She very much does live, and she lives on also in your book. We've talked about a lot. Maybe I hope I haven't pushed it along too quickly. Is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to flag up for the listeners?
No, not so much. You know, only the fact that... you know, of course, it's my book, so I've got all kinds of good things to say about it, which we all do. But, you know, I for me, writing this book, working on this book was in some ways taking stock, you know, as I said before when we began the conversation, of an archive, right? That the Rani of Jhansi is a figure, but she's also a representational archive of colonial and post-colonial literature, history, and gender. And in some ways, my book tries to engage with this archive to see, you know, the ways in which the archive produces a figure like the Rani of Jhansi, but also how the Rani of Jhansi in turn then produces the notion of the archive itself. And the fact that, you know, she's a figure of history, but the ways in which history is represented, especially in a place like India and in the context of British and Indian history, remain very important, because she is of the past, but she is very much also of the present, because she's in some ways a touchstone for us to think about the ways in which gender is being configured or reconfigured constantly in India's modernity.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So we've taken up a lot of your time, and again, I'd like to recommend to everyone at home, this really is a beautiful book. It's very nice to read, as well as being very engaging theoretically as well. So this is it's really a wonderful book. So I was wondering, now this book is out, what future projects are you working on?
So my next project is I'm trying to make my book a little bit, well, maybe not a little bit, even more readable than this
okay.
one. So I was really, you know, this is, it's a book which in some ways I'm hoping will also have a popular audience, because the Rani of Jhansi is not simply a figure of history and of literature, but she's a figure of the popular imagination. So I was really hoping for a larger readership and trying to write sentences that, you know, wouldn't lose my reader somewhere. But as I also point out, writing this book has actually freed me up to write even better sentences.
Okay.
So the next project is and I think tenure does that too. The next project is to really write kind of almost a crossover book, which will look at fiction, popular fiction, cinema, and other things, but then also combine those with ethnography, with interviews, with looking at legal text, and so far, tentatively, that the next book is titled Hearth and Independence, Women, Violence, and Modernity in India. And I really want to look at violence against women in India, you know, rape, sexual assault, and domestic violence, but really in the context of India's modernity. That so far, most of these things, and especially within the last 2 to 3 years, as rape in India has become part of, you know, mainstream discussion and reporting and more, that more often than not, the conversation about violence against women in India really has more to do with traditional religious cultural values. And more often than not, it talks about how this violence is really comes out of a kind of almost an anachronistic cultural religious framework and a patriarchy that is rooted in tradition rather than modernity. And I disagree with that. And so in this book, I really want to look at the ways in which what we're seeing as violence against women in India is deeply rooted in India's formation of its own modernity, and it has more to do with being modern and in configuring the modern public sphere than it has to do with notions of tradition and culture.
That sounds fascinating. I mean, there was so much nonsense being written about about sexual violence in India, and I especially as a, you know, as a white British man in India, I feel I very dangerous to say anything about it, but you can just feel there's so much so much hot air. So this book sounds you know, perfect. Like we need it to be historicized and contextualized, and especially if you're aiming it for a popular audience as well, this would be wonderful. So we look forward to that book.
Thank you so much. I guess in some ways, my family perhaps may not like reading it, but, you know, in some ways, I feel like I want to be able to now write a book that people at home can read.
Sure. Okay, so thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Oh, I'm sorry?
I was just going to say thank you so much for doing this, for so many other authors and for other books as well. I really wanted to take the opportunity also to thank you. It's really wonderful that you're doing this. Thank you so much.
No, it was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to New Books in South Asian Studies. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Today we've been talking about the Rani of Jhansi, Gender, History and Fable in India by Harleen Singh. beautiful book that I can't recommend enough. Hope to see you next time. Ta-ra.